from the campus of Stanford University.
Now, DNA contains the blueprints for how your cells live, how they grow, how they interact with other cells.
This is the future of everything.
Like a computer program, it allows the cell to perform simple computations to make decisions about when and where things happen.
With your host, Russ Altman.
Today on the future of everything, the future of innovation for COVID-19. Well, I'm not surprising anyone when I say that the COVID-19 pandemic has hit the world hard. It has created unprecedented challenges for healthcare, the economy, transportation, the government, all sectors of life. But at the core, COVID-19 is an infectious disease that requires medical care. As we know, some experience the disease as a modest syndrome. Others have absolutely no symptoms. But some get very sick and have severe problems, especially breathing. They require hospitalization and sometimes assistance in breathing with ventilators. It became clear early in this pandemic that the global supply chain for basic respiratory support and other protective equipment was inadequate. There were not enough masks for healthcare workers especially, but also for regular people trying to do their business as essential workers and others. There was not enough ventilators, the breathing machines. And worst of all, there was no great plan or capability to meet these needs in a timely fashion. Some might argue there still is not. Well, Dr. Manu Prakash, a professor of bioengineering at Stanford, has made a reputation for engineering inventions that are inexpensive, openly available to all, and based on a profound understanding of how to use the principles of physics to accomplish tasks that would otherwise seem to require expensive and proprietary solutions. Manu actually has appeared on this show. He's one of our 120 so previous guests, actually aired February 10th, 2018, for those of you who can't get enough of Manu, where he discussed his work creating a microscope, the Foldscope, that cost $1, a centrifuge called the Paperfuge that cost 25 cents. And no one was surprised, therefore, when he turned his attention to creating innovative solutions for COVID-19. Manu, there are so many things needed during this crisis. How did you decide where to focus the effort initially on the pandemic, given the enormity of challenges that as they became clear to you?
Thank you for having me, Russ. It's really a great pleasure to both talk to you, but to talk to the broader community at large. I think the pandemic for me has had a personal context to it. I happened to be in France when the pandemic was starting to peak. So I saw some of the challenges that were unfolding in France when I was returning back. And I think to me, the big surprise was as you could see the signs of what will then eventually turn out to be a really tricky situation, both in Europe itself. And then when I came back, I didn't see any sense of preparedness. I walked through the airport with absolutely nobody asking me where I was coming from, with absolutely no temperature checks, and even no hint of, as a society, us starting to plan for it. I ended up, for some reasons, at the hospital early on, and just starting to see the fact that a doctor would walk in into my room almost three times when the doctor came in. They had PPE at that time, and they would throw it away every single time. And it just starting to connect. I was in personally in isolation and quarantine when I returned. It started to dawn on the fact that we were not connecting the dots. There was enough of an indication that we need to be prepared, but both from the perspective of just general preparedness as a society, the sense of preparedness that it comes from the protective equipment, and then of course the general healthcare system. And my prior work in developing countries has taught me that the only way when you can see an indicator is to really be prepared as much as possible. So I think early on as a lab, we pivoted to saying that we will drop everything that we are doing and only focus on this. And, you know, I think it really is the strength of the students involved as well that we were able to at least start churning the wheels. There was no other choice.
So there are several amazing projects that I want to talk about. Did they literally start, and before we get to them, did they start in parallel, or did you pick one first and then the others got added on?
I think it started in parallel. We identified three very critical areas. One is, of course, in the context of diagnostics. The other is in the context of protecting our healthcare workers. And then the last one is from a perspective of critical care for patients. They all started in parallel, and it's been the wildest ride of my life, frankly. And the strength of what we've been able to do has depended on partnerships and collaborations. So of course they seeded in my lab, but we've been completely open. I distinctly remember a moment one night thinking we have to think differently about starting these projects. And I wrote down 6 Google Docs that are open, that are still actually available online in a single day. And all of those Google Docs were inklings of an idea. And communities built around those. And I think, you know, what has been powerful has been is, of course, we've been steering much of this work in our lab, but this work belongs to communities around the world. Every single project has contributors from 10, 15 countries. There are governments involved providing feedback from clinicians, but it was all anchored around Google Docs.
Unbelievable. Well, so let's give people a feel for what we're talking about here, because these are just amazing. So you gave 3. If I was listening carefully, I believe you said diagnostics, protective equipment, and then the issue of critical care. So let's go to diagnostics first. What's been the activity there? I've read a little bit about it, but bring people up to speed.
Yeah, I think the diagnostics bit was around the time, and of course, everybody, if some of you have even gotten this test done with the RT-PCR, with the nasal swab done, the challenge that we saw there was cost. We were on a phone call with NGO in Bolivia, where a single individual to get a test would have to pay around $400 to get a test. When you're talking about a pandemic and you're talking about a global population, the cost structure doesn't make sense. So for us, it was a simple, I first posed it as a class problem, as a challenge. How do we make a test that costs $1 and that is accessible? And early on, and actually ironically now, what's happening as a diagnostic debate in the country, we are realizing that just the standard framework that we have that for diagnosing of people, individuals, is not the same framework that we need for population surveillance. So for us, the idea was to start with a type of a test that is rapid to do, that could adapt it to be even do it at home, and use saliva as a starting point. And my kids play with this little flashlight. And this is literally exactly the flashlight that I borrowed from my kids to build a completely electricity-free COVID test. It's called HandiFuge Lamp. It's based on an amplification process, but it's isothermal. This is what the first prototype actually looked like. And at this point, we've been able to build a test that purely uses saliva and can be implemented without electricity in essentially from a context of, we were primarily thinking of primary health centers around the world, but we are now starting to pivot again and realizing that the framework of testing in US itself requires home tests and yes, requires tests outside the framework. So that was the inkling of an idea. And at this point, we are in validation phase. We have shipped the first sets of tests to our partners in Bolivia.
So it doesn't require electricity, but you have the device, which looks like a plastic, not very expensive device. And what about the reagents? Are they going to be limiting?
Yeah, the reagents for these are the first round of reagents are coming from NEB, but in parallel, several other groups were working on making open source reagents, and there is a group in Austria that has just added them on AdGene, enzymes that are completely open, and we have now taken their work and started building lyophilized reagents ourselves. So if there is any place around the world that can grow bacteria, potentially they have access to these reagents. I think, again, the challenge sort of in many of the projects that we would go back and in what regulatory framework do we now implement a technology, which probably, hopefully we get a chance to talk about.
Yes. I think probably all three of these, or at least two out of three of these topics. So let's hold that, because I'm sure, I'm sure there will also be questions. Okay. So that's fantastic. There's this device. It's in the middle of validation, but it may bring an electricity-free, relatively inexpensive, global open source diagnostic. And is it yes, no for active disease? Is that the goal, or is it a antibody serology type test?
No, this is really a nucleic acid test for a yes, no for an active disease. I think our target is primarily to isolate people that are spreading the disease. That's the primary goal for this test in some sense. And again, if people have resources, they could get a second validation test later on as well.
And you made a reference to the fact that there can be very innovative multiplexing of these tests. So you can pool them, see if anybody in the group was positive. If you get a positive, you can divide and conquer. So as you point out, there are kind of, I would almost call them algorithmic opportunities for how to do this in an efficient way. Are you able to pin a price on this diagnostic, or are there too many unknowns at this point?
I mean, I think because it's an open source technology, anybody can implement. The cost of the hardware costs us around $5 to $10 to build. And effectively, the reagents per test are roughly around $1 using the current framework. But if we do bring the work from, of course, the first round of reagents were developed by a lab at Harvard. They have openly shared their reagents. The second round of those reagents were developed by a lab in Austria. They have openly shared their reagents. So my intuition is that if we scale from a reagent perspective, we'll be able to bring down the cost per test to be less than $1.
So let's move to category two, which was the protective equipment, both for healthcare workers and others. What was the challenge there, and what was the approach?
I think on the protective side, just it's heartbreaking to see what healthcare workers have had to go through in this pandemic. I've had my own personal family members involved, and just when I would pick up the phone and they would be told that we are in the best hospital in the world and you get one, just doesn't make sense. So I think from an emotional perspective, I think I've just often felt this, that there was such a great need and the response from a systematic perspective was just not there. So that was the starting point. I think we really asked ourselves a primary question is, how do we protect healthcare workers? That was the primary. And the aspect of this was, again, I think, we often approach this in the ideas come from a very broad range of solutions, but we wanted to anchor ourselves in validating, because this is now a critical care equipment, and although it might look simple, it requires the kind of validation before we would be comfortable. And the approach we took was, I happen to love snorkeling and diving, and while playing with this, I had happened to have my own snorkeling masks. I don't know how many of you have used these full face masks. The history of these masks is they actually come from the gas mask industry for protective equipment itself. We asked ourselves a question, could we adapt these tools to build a protective gear for a healthcare worker? The advantage is this is a reusable solution. So it couples to a filter that's already used in the ventilator industries. So these filters can last literally almost a week. There is an injection molded set of parts that we had to build to be biocompatible. And then the snorkel mask itself protects both the eye and the breathing. And then it has an elastomeric seal around it. So you can actually, any of you who get the PPE fit test realize that many times they don't actually fit.
So the mask you just showed us, mm-hmm. that has been modified. That is post-modification. And I saw a little filter apparatus that was added on by your team.
That's correct. Yeah. So we start with a commercial mask and we modify it. We work with Boston Scientific on this to get the regulatory submissions. But one of the things that happened was I literally posted this on Twitter. And a few weeks later, we had a team of, individuals from 22 countries engaged in this process. We filed for regulatory approvals, which is the hardest part of this, because we have to prove that this is as effective. And that was the non-trivial. And that led to a 45-page paper that's on MedArchive now, which is the idea is simple, but to really have the efficacy to prove that we can do N95 level fitness and filtration. So at this point, this has been approved in France. We deployed somewhere around 25,000 of them in France, around 10,000 in Belgium. There is of the order of 5 to 10,000 in Latin America. Last week, we are just shipping our parts to Honduras, Colombia, Chile. We've deployed around 5 to 6,000 in the US. And one of the factors has been is because, again, it's an open source project, we have provided all the instructions for people to implement this. And from a waste product perspective, if you look at the number of PPEs and the disposable culture that we have in medicine, that leads to a massive healthcare waste that some countries are capable of handling, but many other countries don't have the kind of framework for biological waste. So the other aspect of this is really looking long term. Should we really be building types of products that are critical care that should be reusable?
Yes.
And the key here is you can decontaminate it in a simple bleach solution every night before you use it again.
What are we talking about here in terms of the cost?
Yeah, $20 for the snorkel mask and $2 for the plastic injection molded piece. And then the filters that are used cost $3 to $4. But then again, the filters can be used for a week. The mask could be used for, you know, 4 or 5 months. When you do the add up the numbers, it's cheaper than an N95. We were thinking about this context of long-term use is going to be important. And of course, the N95 costs, it's one aspect is cost, but most countries that we've been engaged with, they have never had a supply of N95. So the challenge also here is accessibility and cost have kind of collided in some sense.
Right.
Yeah.
What are the reports from the users about the mask? Are stories with the tens of thousands that you've referred to, I'm guessing that you've gotten feedback, maybe even enough to think about the next review.
Yeah, I think we did a very formal study. We worked with Boston Scientific to deploy the first 1,000 units. We got formal feedbacks and approvals. But with the way the COVID has been, is there has been informal networks. Every other week, we run a clinical call of users, and they teach each other. Like just before this call, I just got a message from Honduras, and the group realized that there are no Spanish translations on our new mask website. And they said, we will do the Spanish translations because we're deploying this, and we need people to understand how to do donning and doffing. And suddenly, a doctor from Miami just said, hey, I have a professional training in doing translations for medical. So I think it really is about the community, and giving them the ownership of engaging has been phenomenal. All of the reports and things are publicly documented. We have an Excel sheet that's publicly accessible with people's feedback. And of course, the feedback led to a lot of work that we had to do on our end to make it comfortable. What are the pounds that people should use a solution? And of course, since this is not an FDA approved or a regulatory product, we primarily state if you have access to a PPE, you should use that if this is essentially a last resort solution. Of course, prior to if people are resorting to bandanas and other things that were also reported in the CDC.
This is the future of everything. I'm Russ Altman. More with Professor Manu Prakash about the inventions coming out of his lab to combat COVID next on Sirius XM.
The future of everything with Russ Altman
from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. I'm speaking with Professor Manu Prakash about COVID-19 and low-cost open source ways to get new technologies to the aid of caregivers and patients for COVID-19. So in the last segment, Manu, we were talking about some remarkable diagnostics. You talked about this great mask. I know you've done some work also with masks based on what I will call the cotton candy principle. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is, we call this the factory in a box solution. And this has been thinking quite a lot about distributed manufacturing. So, you know, when I spoke to doctors in Bangladesh and many of my colleagues there, the answer was, look, we have never had a supply chain of things like this. And the question we asked was, how do you manufacture N95 grade materials in the middle of nowhere? And that you know, if any of you have read and think about how N95 masks work, it's primarily this micro nanofiber meshed material. And almost 6 years ago, I had imaged my kids' cotton candy using a Foldscope, and I remembered the fibrous material that comes from there. And we took that approach. We literally went to Amazon, bought 6 cotton candy machines, and using reusable plastic, we were able to convert them into a material that actually matches N95 filtration efficiency. So that's another paper that's posted. The technology is completely open source. We have partnered with 2 large-scale manufacturing entities. And the goal for this is to not replace the 3Ms of the world that make it in a centralized manner, but the 3M plant can make around 1.5 million masks per day. But instead, if you have 1,000 factories making 1,000 to 10,000 masks per day, which is much smaller than a 3M factory, when you multiply that together, that's a supply for tens of millions of masks produced locally. So that's the vision that we have applied. At this point, we are in the process of developing and productizing these machines, and there's a lot of quality control that we have to build in. But the main principle remains. We have been actually able to demonstrate that you can make. There are groups in Australia, Israel, Japan, locations in the US, who are India, who are taking this principle and starting to build a complete mask-making factory. The first place we were applying this to is masks for the public, because it's a sort of a barrier of entry is lower, but you still require higher and higher grade filtration with good breathability. You know, making a filter is trivial if you don't care about breathability. You could put a massive thing on you, but the breathability is the hardest part. So I think the project is growing. And again, it's been in this scenario where we have had to implement quality control in manufacturing.
So you initially did it with cotton candy machines from Amazon. And was it, how close to the right mesh widths did you get? Was it just a proof of concept, or did we just get incredibly lucky that these machines actually matched the requirements of an N95?
The physics is the same. Huh. So the melt-blown principle relies on extrusion, but primarily it's a meshed fiber. And as long as we're using the same polymers and the same charging principle. So we had to modify the cotton candy machine.
Right. Variance needs to come down, is my guess.
Yeah, I think the key bit is to be connected to a Van de Graaff generator. I don't know if how many of you remember the things you watch in a museum to make your hair stand up. So we have to apply charging, high voltage charge to it so that the material is charged. And the importance is the choosing the right polymers. And we did a lot of work on this, but the direction we are taking this is how do we turn a cradle to cradle solution for PPE in the future? So primarily, we've been able to now demonstrate with this approach that using just completely waste plastics in our waste streams, we can generate a very valuable product. In the middle of nowhere, the entire factory essentially fits on a tabletop, including the mask manufacturing.
Just because of time, I want to go to the third category that you mentioned in your introductory comment, which was about critical support and ventilators. And I know you've had a couple of innovations there. Which one would you like to speak about first?
I think we should talk about pufferfish.
So what is pufferfish? It sounds good, and it sounds like something that a patient would want to do, puff.
Pufferfish is primarily a full-feature ICU ventilator that's open source. And the key bit there was many of you saw open source. I mean, everybody who was a card-carrying engineer was building ventilators when this pandemic started. But unfortunately, the clinical feedback was not so strong and was not taken into account. There are lots of resuscitators that were made, which are these ambu bags that are squeezed. And they're okay if you're supporting a patient for a short period of time. But if you're really supporting somebody for 15 to 30 days, you require the kinds of clinical features that a traditional ventilator has. And I think we saw this massive gap that EUAs for many resuscitators have been given, but I'm not aware of even one of them actually implemented on a COVID patient. So we took an approach which was slightly different. We asked, essentially, we pulled clinicians from Kenya, Nepal, India, Bangladesh, and of course, US. And we made a feature list that required us that this is the essential features for a COVID-19 patient. And that feature list drove our design, but we also wanted to make sure that this is going to be completely open source. and not dependent on the medical supply chain. So the key components that we use in our ventilators, actually many of them come from the automotive industry because they are that massively available, the key, the pinch valve that we actually use. And currently, if you go to what we call PES Globo's website, you can see this ventilator. We have submitted to the EUA process with the FDA. But the key aspect of this work, this is a collaboration between three universities, Stanford, of course, Kai Cook from University of Utah, who's an anesthesiology, and Dan Harris from Brown. We knew to build an ICU ventilator that is going through an FDA, it requires 4 to 5 years.
Right, which you don't really have.
Which we don't have. And so we really had to deploy a strategy of distributed design and distributed manufacturing with the goal, I think I compare our effort to thinking about building the Mozilla or the Firefox of the browser world, but for a ventilator, which is a reference design. And manufacturers can then adapt that reference design for their local context. Currently, we have three manufacturers in India, Nepal, and Kenya that are manufacturing the units while we undertake the EUA responsibility of going through an EUA approval for this device.
Unbelievable. How have the industrial partners, the car makers, the air conditioner makers, whoever makes parts that are relevant, how have they stepped up? Has it been smooth or have there been unexpected wrinkles?
I think that's been the most joyful part of the, if there is anything joyful about working on COVID, is the reception and engagement that we've had from the industry. So the partner in India is essentially one of the largest part makers for automotive industry. It's a multinational. And then what it allows us to do is to really scale our manufacturing and bring their team's capacity. In Kenya, if we succeed, this would be the very first ventilator manufactured in Africa. And the purpose of this is going beyond COVID. I think you have to use this crisis as you look at the numbers. Almost 80 to 85% of every dollar spent on medical device industry is spent primarily in Europe and US from a research and R&D and development perspective.
Thank you for listening to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app.
This has been The Future of Everything with Russ Altman on SiriusXM Business Radio.
If you missed any of it, listen on demand,
online or with the SiriusXM app.